Hey guys, what you're about to listen to was actually once an exclusive podcast over on my Patreon account, which can be found at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. Over there, for as little as $2 a month, you get access to my exclusive Patreon podcast, early access to all of the content I create, and voting rights for what I will tackle next. This episode covers one of my favorite characters of the Pacific War, General Tomoyuki Yamashita, and how he earned his title, the Tiger of Malaya. This episode is specifically going to cover his invasion of Malaya and the taking of Singapore. The reason why I'm releasing this outside the Patreon account is because I'm probably going to be making an entire series on Tomoyuki Yamashita. Thus, this would be episode 1. I do hope you enjoy this episode, and please, if you find the time, go over to the Pacific War Channel Discord and tell me what you think of the podcast. Or, if it's easier for you, just simply go over to my YouTube channel, The Pacific War Channel, and comment on any of my videos. Just say where you came from. But without further ado, this is how Tomoyuki Yamashita became the Tiger of Malaya. So, if you're a longtime listener of the Pacific War Week by Week podcast series over at KNG, or a viewer of my YouTube channel, you've probably heard me talk a bit about Tomoyuki Yamashita, the Tiger of Malaya, quite often. It goes without saying, when it comes to Japanese generals of World War II, he stands out. And not just for me. From the offset of the war, he made a large impression on Westerners. He achieved incredible feats early on in the war. Now, if you look up books about him, you will pretty much find only information in regards to his infamous war crimes trial. Hell, it was very infamous, the legal doctrine of hierarchical accountability for war crimes, whereby a commanding officer is legally responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by his subordinates, was created. This became known as the Command Responsibility, or the Yamashita Standard. His court case was very controversial. He remains a controversial figure, certainly to the people of territories he campaigned in. But I think what can be said of him the most is he was special amongst the Japanese generals. Anyways, let's get on with the show. So who was Yamashita? When he was 59 years old, commanding forces in the Philippines against General Douglas MacArthur, he weighed 220 pounds and he stood about 5 feet 9 inches. His girth pressed against his green army uniform. He was a thick boy. He had an egg-shaped head, he was balding, he had wide-spaced eyes and he had a flat nose. He wore a short mustache, pretty much like Hitler's, until it grayed on him, then he shaved it off. He was not a very attractive man. Filipinos actually referred to him as Old Potato Face, while Americans would call him a florid pig-faced man. Tomobumi Yamashita was born in 1885. He was the second son to Dr. Sakichi Yamashita and Yu Yamashita in Osugi village of Shikoku Island. Like most males of his day, he was indoctrinated into military preparatory school from a very young age. Yamashita had no choice in his career for the army, and in his words, "My father suggested the idea because I was big and healthy, and my mother did not seriously object because she believed, bless her soul, that I would never pass the highly competitive entrance examination. If I had only been cleverer or had worked harder, I would have been a doctor like my brother." Yamashita would graduate from the 18th class of the IGA Academy in November of 1905, ranked 16th out of 920 cadets. In 1908, he was promoted to the rank of lieutenant, and during World War I, he fought against Imperial Germany and Austro-Hungary in the famous Siege of Qingdao. And if you're interested, I did an episode on the Siege of Qingdao on my YouTube channel. Check it out. It's actually a very interesting battle that's overlooked. A lot of historical firsts happen, like the first technical carrier raid. In 1916, he was promoted to captain, and he attended the 28th class of the Army War College to graduate 6th in his class that year. That same year, he also married Hisako Nagayama. She was the daughter of a retired general, Nagayama. It seems Yamashita's brush against the Germans in 1914 had a huge influence on him, because he became fascinated with Germany, and he would serve as an assistant military attaché at Bern and Berlin from 1919 to 1922. He spent his time in Germany alongside one Captain Hideki Tojo. Both men would run into each other countless times and become bitter rivals throughout their lives. Both men toured the Western Front, visited Hamburg, and witnessed firsthand the crippling inflation and food prices that came from Germany's defeat. Yamashita would go on the record to say to Tojo at this time, If Japan ever has to fight any nation, she must never surrender and get herself in a state like this. He returned to Japan in 1922. He was promoted to major. He served a few different posts in the Imperial Headquarters and Staff College. Yamashita became a leading member of the Kodaha faction, while Tojo became a leading member of the rival Tosaha faction. In 1927, Yamashita was sent again to Europe, this time to Vienna as a military attaché. Just prior to departing, he had invested in a business selling thermometers, started by one of his wife's relatives. The business failed horribly, and Yamashita was tossed into debt. Bailiffs literally came to seize his house. As told to us by his official biographer, "For a regular officer to have contracted such a debt, however innocently, was a disgrace. He felt he should resign his commission." Yamashita's brother refused to allow him to quit, instructing him to leave for Vienna while he would resolve his debts. His days in Vienna were the best of his life, professed by himself. He studied economics at Vienna University. He made friends with a Japanese widow who introduced him to a German woman named Kitty, and they had an affair. This would spring forward his reputation as an eccentric officer. Yamashita was obsessed with hygiene. He refused to eat fruit unless it was thoroughly washed. He avoided ice water, hated dancing, and never learned how to drive a car. One of his most notable quirks was his habit of falling asleep often during meetings where he would legendarily snore. Like I may have said in the previous podcast and YouTube episodes, this guy was quite a character, often described as a big bear. Now, I'm not going to run down a full biography on Yamashita, so I can't delve too far into certain things, such as his first fall from grace. During the February 26 coup incident of 1936, Yamashita was a leading member of the Kodaha faction, and he helped mediate a peaceful end to the standoff. However, in truth, he was actually backing the coup. He simply managed to not get caught red-handed doing too much for the mutineers. Regardless, he lost favor with the outraged emperor, and many young captains who he loved like sons killed themselves in disgrace. If you really want to know more about the February coup of 1936, please check out my former series on Emperor Hirohito or on General Ishiwara Kanshi. They both talk in depth about the incident from different perspectives, and they do touch upon Yamashita's role a bit. The coup led to the dissolvement of the Kodaha faction and the dominance of the Tosaha, led by Hideki Tojo. Yamashita tried to resign from the IGA, but his superiors dissuaded him. He was relegated to a post in Korea, which honestly was more of an exile or a punishment. Yamashita would go on the record to say, "When I was posted in Korea, I felt I had been given a tactful promotion, but in fact my career was over. Even when I was given my first fighting company in North China, I still felt I had no future in the army. So I was always on the front line, where the bullets flew the thickest. I sought only a place to die." He had a lot of time to reflect upon his conduct while in Korea. He began to study Zen Buddhism. He was promoted to Lieutenant General in November of 1937, and when the China War broke out, he was one of those speaking out against the incident, stating it needed to end swiftly, and that peaceful relations must be made with the UK and the US. He received an unimportant post in the Kwangtung Army. In 1938, he was assigned command of the IGA 4th Division. He led the forces in northern China against insurgents, until he returned to Tokyo in July of 1940. His fellow officers lauded him as Japan's finest general. Meanwhile, Tojo had ascended to war minister, and one of his first moves was to send a delegation to Germany. Tojo considered Yamashita a ruthless and forceful commander, and he feared he would become a powerful rival against him one day. Yamashita would go on the record to say of Tojo, "I have nothing against Tojo, but apparently he has something against me." You see, Yamashita was the kind of man that had no political ambitions, unlike Tojo, who was by nature a political monster. In Yamashita's words, "My life is that of a soldier. I do not seek any other life unless our emperor calls me." In late 1940, Tojo asked Yamashita to lead a team of 40 experts on a six-month train tour of Germany and Italy, a move that kept him out of Tokyo, because Tojo was trying to solidify his political ambitions. This is going to become a looming theme between the two men. He was presented to Adolf Hitler in January of 1941, passing along messages from Tojo and publicly praising the Führer, though privately he was very unimpressed by the man. "He may be a great orator on a platform, with his gestures and flamboyant way of speaking, but standing behind his desk listening, he seems much more like a clerk." Hitler pressed upon him to push Japan to declare war on Britain and the United States. At the time, of course, Japan was facing China and had two major conflicts with the USSR. Thus, this was absolutely not in her interest. "My country is still fighting in China, and we must finish that war as soon as possible. We are also afraid that Russia may attack us in Manchuria. This is no time for us to declare war on other countries." Yamashita hoped to inspect Germany's military technology and techniques to help Japan. Hitler promised open exchanges of information, stating, "All of our secrets are open to you." But this would prove to be pretty much a lie. As Yamashita tells us, "There were several pieces of equipment the Germans did not want us to see. Whenever I tried to persuade the German general staff to show us things like radar, about which we had only a rudimentary knowledge, the conversation always turned to something else." Yamashita met with Field Marshal Hermann Göring, who gave him an overview of the war in Europe. Göring would complain about Yamashita falling asleep during lectures and meetings, and he believed the man was drunk quite often. Yamashita also met Benito Mussolini in June of 1941, receiving a similar rundown to what he got in Germany. Yamashita also, of course, visited Kitty in Vienna for a quick fling. And overall, the trip deeply impacted Yamashita's resolve that Japan should stay out of the European war, and that Germany had made a grievous error invading the USSR in June of 1941. Before returning to Japan, he said this to the members of his commission. "You know the results of our inspection as well as I do. I must ask you not to express opinion in favor of expanding the alliance between Japan, Germany, and Italy. Never suggest in your report that Japan should declare war on Great Britain and the United States. We must not and cannot rely upon the power of other nations. Japan needs more time, particularly as there may be aggression against us from the Russians. We must have time to rebuild our defense system and adjust the whole Japanese war machine. I cannot repeat this to you often enough." His report was similar, and it really, really pissed off Tojo, who was trying to develop plans for a war against America. Yamashita would then get exiled to Manchuria in July of 1941. But Tojo's resentment towards him could only go so far, because Yamashita was one of their very best generals. And in his planned war against Britain and America, he would need such a man. Now, Yamashita's time in Europe reshaped his views on how to conduct war. He saw firsthand Blitzkrieg warfare, and it fascinated him. He consistently urged the implementation of new proposals calling for the streamlining of air arms, to mechanize the army, to integrate control of the armed forces in a defense ministry coordinated by a chairman or joint chiefs of staff, to create a paratroop corps, and to employ effective propaganda against potential enemies. Basically, he saw what was working for the Germans against the Allies, and he wanted Japan to replicate it. Tojo did not like many of the proposals, hated the fact they were coming from Yamashita, as you can imagine, so he obviously was not keen on making them happen. Luckily for Yamashita, he would be given a chance to implement some of his ideas in a very big way. On November the 6th of 1941, Lieutenant General Yamashita was appointed commander of the 25th Japanese Army. His orders were to seize the Malay Peninsula and then the British naval base at Singapore. The Malay Peninsula snakes 700 miles south of Thailand, a rugged sliver of land that constricts at its narrowest point to about 60 miles wide. It holds mountains that split the peninsula in half, some going as high as 7,000 feet. During this time, Malaya produced around 40% of the world's rubber and 60% of its tin, two resources vital for war. At its very southern tip lies Singapore, a diamond-shaped island connected to the mainland by a 1,115-feet stone causeway. Singapore's largest asset was its naval base, guarding the passage from the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Together, Mali and Singapore represented the key to controlling what Japan called the Southern Resource Area, that being the rest of Southeast Asia and the Dutch East Indies. Singapore was known as the Gibraltar of the East, and for good reason. It was a massively fortified naval base. The base had been developed between 1923 to 1938, and it cost about £60 million, around £2 billion by today's standard. It was 21 square miles, had the largest dry dock in the world, and the third largest floating dock, and enough fuel tanks to support the entire Royal Navy for 6 months. The fortress was defended by 15-inch naval guns stationed at the Johor Battery, Changi, and Buena Vista Battery. And I will say this, despite the infamous myth some of you may have heard or read from certain books, these 15-inch naval guns were fully capable of turning in all directions, including to target the mainland. For those of you unaware and asking yourselves why I'm saying this, there was a myth perpetuated after the fall of Singapore that her very large 15-inch naval guns could not turn to hit the mainland, and that this had spelt her doom. This is not true. What actually ended up happening in the future battle was that these naval guns were armed almost exclusively with armor-piercing rounds. Armor-piercing rounds are used to hit ships, which makes sense because this is a naval base and these guns were primarily supposed to be shooting any enemy ships coming to attack it. Now, armor-piercing rounds are pretty much useless in a land battle. You see, the rounds are made specifically so that they penetrate a target before exploding. So if you shoot them at the land, they'll probably go a few feet into the dirt or the sand and explode underneath, doing pretty much no damage to anything around it. High explosive shells, on the other hand, would explode upon contact and send shrapnel to kill a lot of guys. So these 15-inch naval guns basically did very little during what was the Battle of Singapore, and for some reason this led a lot of people to believe that it was because they couldn't turn to shoot at the enemy. Now, alongside the 15-inch monsters, there were countless other artillery pieces such as 9.2-inch guns. By December of 1941, Mali and Singapore held 164 first-line aircraft, out of a total of about 253 aircraft. But many of the fighters were things like the obsolete Brewster F-2A Buffalo, which was a pretty slow, fat little beast that could take a licking because it did have a lot of armor, but against the Zero Fighter, it was unbelievably outmatched in speed and maneuverability. If you're actually interested in learning more about the Brewster Buffalo, I wrote a script for Kings and Generals, and the episode came out, and I have to say, lackluster results and views. We had a conversation, me and the heads at KNG, and it just seems that people are not that interested in aircraft videos, because I wrote like 8 other scripts, from the Zero Fighter to the Hellcat, and, you know, you name it. Now, the Japanese acquired a major gift prior to the outbreak of the Pacific War. On November the 11th of 1940, the SS Automedon, a German raider, attacked the HMS Atlantis, which was carrying documents intended for the British Far East Command. The documents indicated the British fleet was not going to help Singapore, that Britain would not declare war if Thailand was invaded, and that Hong Kong was pretty much expendable. The Germans gave the documents to the Japanese, who were, well, very excited to find out this information. Starting in January of 1941, Colonel Masanobu Tsuji led the Taiwan Army Research Section based on Formosa to investigate how a campaign could be waged in Mali and Singapore. His findings on the defenses of Mali and Singapore were summed up in these 3 points. Number one, Singapore fortress was solid and strong facing the sea, but vulnerable on the peninsular side facing the Johor Strait. Number two, newspaper reports of a strong Royal Air Force presence were simply propaganda. Number three, although British forces in Malaya numbered from 5 to 6 divisions, well over 80,000 men, less than half were Europeans. Now, just a little bit about Tsuji, as he was to become the chief of staff of operations and planning under Yamashita. Tsuji was extremely insubordinate and a political schemer. He was a member of the Tosa faction, a fanatic loyalist to Tojo, and definitely, by proxy, an enemy to Yamashita. Yamashita would write of Tsuji in his war diary, "Tsuji is egotistical and willy. He is a sly dog and unworthy to serve the country. He is a manipulator, to be carefully watched. For those of you who aren't familiar with Soichi, because he's a very infamous character, he had an infamous reputation for ordering atrocities in the name of his superiors, often without them knowing, and this would be very much the case under Yamashita. And also, to be quite frank, it really does seem to be the case that Tojo had personally selected Soichi to be under Yamashita to spy on him, and to, well, I can't say it another way, to fuck with him. Now, using Soichi's intelligence, Yamashita began plans at his HQ at Sama, a port on Hainan Island, starting in about November of 1941. This is all on how to launch a campaign. He was initially offered 5 divisions for the invasion, but he felt he could accomplish it with just 3. There were actually a few reasons why he believed this. First, Soichi's research suggested the peninsula roads would be the center of the battlefront, and that the flanks would be extended no more than a kilometer or so to the left or right, due to the dense jungle terrain. Well, Yamashita was planning to assault from the jungle specifically. Second, intelligence indicated the defending troops were not of the highest caliber. The British were, after all, way too busy in Europe, thus many of the troops in Southeast Asia were poorly trained. Half of them were British regulars, the rest were Australians, Indian, and Malayans. Third, Yamashita was aware, quote, "The Japanese army were in the habit of flinging more troops into the battle than could possibly be maintained." Boy, oh boy, tell that one to the future boys put on Guadalcanal. Yamashita was before his time, I think. He had a deep understanding of the logistical problems Japan was going to be facing in the upcoming war. He was a realist. He calculated 3 divisions was the maximum to be fed, equipped, and supplied on such a campaign. Based on his recommendations, the 25th Army was created with 3 divisions. The 5th Division under Lieutenant General Takuma Matsue, the 18th Division under Lieutenant General Renya Mataguchi, and the Imperial Guards Division of Lieutenant General Takuma Nishimura. Supporting these would be 2 regiments of heavy field artillery and the 3rd Tank Brigade. Something that made Yamashita's campaign quite interesting was the usage and amount of tanks. He was invading with around 200 or so tanks, at least initially. This was consisting of the Type 95 Ha-Go light tank, the Type 97 Chi-Ha and Type 89 E-Go medium tanks, and the Type 97 Te-K tankettes. For aircraft, he had the 3rd Air Division, 459 aircraft strong, with an additional 159 aircraft from the IGN to support them. The 3rd Air Division had a variety of aircraft, such as the Nakajima Ki-27 Nates, Nakajima Ki-43 Oscars, Mitsubishi Ki-51 Sonyas, the Kawasaki Ki-48 Lily, the Mitsubishi Ki-21 Sally, Mitsubishi Ki-30 Ans, Mitsubishi Ki-15 Babs, and Mitsubishi K-46 Dinas. As for the IGN, it was the 22nd Air Flotilla using Mitsubishi G3M1 Nels, Mitsubishi A5M4 Clodes, and some A6M0s. To say he had a lot of firepower at his disposal is an understatement. Yamashita was packing heat. Heat he could use in a blitzkrieg-like fashion. Yamashita's staff at Sama identified 5 operational objectives. Number 1 was the simultaneous capture of Singora and Petani of Thailand and Kotubaru of Malaya. Number 2 was the capture of all enemy airfields in southern Thailand and Malaya. Number 3, the occupation of Kuala Lumpur in Malaya. Number 4, the occupation of the Johor Bahru and control of the Johor Strait. And number 5, the conquest of Singapore. Colonel Soichi, who was appointed as Chief of Operations and Planning for the 25th Army, proposed the following plan, which was readily approved. Number 1, land the main strength of the 5th Division simultaneously and without warning at Singora and Petani, and at the same time land a powerful section of the 18th Division to attack Kotubaru. Number 2, the troops that are disembarking at Singora and Petani would press forward immediately to attack the line of the Perak River and capture its bridge and the Alor Star Aerodrome. And number 3, the troops landing at Kotubaru would press forward along the eastern coast as far as Kuantan. The landing at Kotubaru, the only one in Malaya, was expected to be opposed and quite risky. But if it was successful, it would create a useful diversion away from the main force landings in Thailand. The landings took place around 2:15 a.m. local time on December the 8th. That's about an hour and 20 minutes before the attack on Pearl Harbor. The landings went largely unopposed, except at Kotobaru, where the Japanese saw heavy resistance. The British had anticipated this landing point, and they created Operation Matador, a plan to preemptively invade southern Thailand to secure a defensive line against the Japanese. However, this plan was never accepted by British High Command, for obvious political reasons. You see, Thailand, prior to the outbreak of the Pacific War in 1941, was vying for an alliance with either the Allies or Japan. For months before the outbreak happened, the leader of Thailand tried to get assurances from both parties against the other, and the British were still in the hopes that they could retain some sort of alliance with Thailand. But on December the 5th, with a Japanese invasion looking certain, suddenly London gave permission to the Far East commanders to decide if Operation Matador should be activated or not. The commander in Malaya, General Arthur Percival, recommended forestalling it, fearing to violate Thai sovereignty, which ultimately would be the doom of the defense for Malaya. At the Battle of Kotobaru, the 9th Infantry Division of Major General Baustau attempted holding off the Japanese from taking the important Kotobaru airfield. The 8th Brigade of Billy Key had fortified the beaches with pillboxes, barbed wire, and landmines. The Japanese took heavy losses, but they were able to find gaps and they filled them up rather quickly until Brigadier Key had to ask permission to withdraw. The Royal Air Force at Kotobaru tossed Hudson bombers to hit the troop transports, but it was a suicide mission to do so because of the heavy air support the Japanese held. Meanwhile, the IGA 5th Division landed at Patani and Songkhla in Thailand, while the Imperial Guards Division marched over the border from French Indochina. The Japanese encountered very little resistance. The leader of Thailand, Plak Philbin Songkram, had been trying to get assurances from the Allies and Japanese all the way up until the invasion. But once the Japanese had landed, he knew his best option was to simply play nice and sign an armistice with Japan. This basically spelt doom for Malaya, as the Japanese were given access to Thailand's airfields, which would be used to smash the forward airfields in Malaya. The first day of aerial encounters were catastrophic for the British. General Percival would comment, "The rapidity with which the Japanese got their air attacks going against our aerodromes was quite remarkable. Practically all the aerodromes in Kalatan, Kedah, Wesley, and Penang were attacked, and in most cases fighters escorted the bombers. The performance of the Japanese aircraft of all types, and the accuracy of their bombing, came as an unpleasant surprise. By the evening, our own air force had already been seriously weakened." Brigadier Key withdrew after causing an estimated 800 casualties upon the Japanese, while taking roughly 465. While Kotobaru was being fought over, Percival unleashed Operation Krokal. It was something like a 2.0 of Matador, seeing British forces cross into Thailand to intercept the incoming enemy. Now, just like Operation Matador, this could have been extremely successful. However, it was done at the very last minute. Operation Matador called for having forces already along the border. It was a complete disaster. The British attackers were defeated not only by the Japanese 5th Division, but also some Royal Thai police officers defended their territory. The operation had basically become a race to see who could seize the most important focal point, and the Japanese took it first, decisively. To add to that misery, Force Z, consisting of the battleship HMS Prince of Wales, the battlecruiser Repulse, and four destroyers, tried to intercept the Japanese invasion fleet, only to be completely destroyed by overwhelming Japanese air forces. Within 4 days of the landings, the 5th Division advanced from Singora through the town of Jitra to capture the RAF airfield at Alistar, around 100 miles away. Yamashita managed this using flanking techniques that saw his army take down town after town and airfield after airfield. There were numerous natural obstacles to the advance, such as dense jungles, very long supply lines, torrential rain, and the heat. But he had a secret weapon, bicycles. At Jitra, Percival made his first major stand. Holding Jitra would safeguard the northern airfields of Malaya, but it was a folly to do so, as the airfields in question were not provided adequate aircraft, and the British lacked something extremely important to be able to defend themselves, tanks. Colonel Tsoji saw firsthand the fighting at Jitra, and he had this to report. "Our tanks were ready on the road, and the 20 or so enemy armored cars ahead were literally trampled underfoot. The enemy armored cars could not escape by running away, and they were sandwiched between our medium tanks. It was speed and weight of armor that decided the issue. The British had spread themselves far too thinly across a 14-mile front with jungle on their right flank and rubber plantations and mangrove swamps to their left. Yamashita used innovative blitzkrieg-like tactics. He combined his air, artillery, tanks, and bicycle infantry to punch holes in concentrated attacks, forcing Allied defenders to withdraw. As Percival would write later on in his memoirs, "This withdrawal would have been difficult under the most favorable conditions. With the troops tired, units mixed as a result of the fighting, communications broken, and the night dark, it was inevitable that orders should be delayed, and that in some cases they should never reach the addresses." This is what, in fact, occurred. The withdrawal, necessary as it might have been, was too fast and too complicated for disorganized and exhausted troops, whose disorganization and exhaustion is only increased. Yamashita had ingeniously thought of employing large numbers of bicycles for his infantry so they could keep up the momentum and speed alongside his mechanized forces. Oh, and he didn't bring thousands of bicycles over to Malaya. The real genius was that they were already there ready for him. His intelligence prior to the invasion indicated nearly all civilians in Malaya had bicycles. So when the Japanese came over, they simply stole them. Half of Yamashita's troops moved in motor vehicles while the rest rode on 18,000 bicycles. As noted by Tsuiji, "With the infantry on bicycles, there was no traffic congestion or delay. Wherever bridges were destroyed, the infantry continued their advance, wading across the rivers, carrying their bicycles on their shoulders, or crossing unlocked bridges held up on the shoulders of engineers standing in the stream. The Japanese overwhelmed the defenders, who were forced to fight, flee into the jungles, or flee along the roads where they were simply outsped and captured by the Japanese. The defenders left numerous stores of food, abandoned vehicles, and supplies that Yamashita's men would dub Churchill's allowance. British Lieutenant Colonel Spencer Chapman's was forced to hide on the sides of a road, watching Japanese pedal past, remarking, "The majority were on bicycles in parties of 40 or 50, riding three or four abreast and talking and laughing just as if they were going to a football match." The Japanese had the ability to carry their gear on their bicycles, giving them an enormous advantage over the Allies fleeing on foot. The Japanese could travel faster, further, and less fatigued. When the British destroyed 250 bridges during their flight, as I said before, "The Japanese infantry, to continue their advance, waded across the rivers, carrying their bicycles on their shoulders, or crossing on log bridges held up on the shoulders of engineers standing in the stream." The British could not escape the bicycle blitzkrieg, as it became known. Countless were forced to surrender under constant pressure and relentless pursuit. Alongside the bicycle warfare, whenever Yamashita faced terrain unsuitable for his tanks, he ordered amphibious landings further south to outflank the enemy's rear. Meanwhile, the war in the air went equally terrible for the Allies. The RAF had pulled back its best pilots and aircraft to deal with the war for Britain against the Luftwaffe. 21 airfields were in Malaya and Singapore. Few of them had modern facilities, only 15 concrete runways. The heavy rain made the grass airstrips unusable. All the airfields were allocated around 8 heavy and 8 light anti-aircraft guns. Quality radar units were completely inadequate. The Super Spitfires and Hyper Hurricanes were mostly in Britain fighting the Germans, while Buffaloes were allocated to Malaya. The Japanese air forces easily overcame the Allied opposition and established air superiority quite quickly. Launching from airfields in Vietnam, they bombed all the airfields into submission and continuously applied pressure to Singapore. The aerial dominance of the Zero and Oscar fighters served to undermine the morale of British infantrymen on the ground. As historian H.P. Wilmot has observed, "In the opening phase of the war, the Zero-sen was just what the Japanese needed, and the Allies were devastated by the appearance of a super fighter." To add insult to injury, every airfield taken, starting at the most northern going further and further south towards Singapore, offered the Japanese new launching points to make for faster attacks. Yamashita's forces reached the southern tip of the peninsula in just 8 weeks. His men had covered some 700 miles, about 12 miles a day on average. They fought 95 large and smaller battles doing so. Multiple lines of defense were erected, one after another, to try and halt the Japanese advance, to kill their momentum. Starting at the beach landings, to Jitra, then Kampar, over to the Slim River, then Johor. The British failed to employ leave-behind forces to provide guerrilla warfare in the lost territories, leading not only to the Japanese easily consolidating their gains, but also the Thai had come down to grab some territory. At the Battle of Muar, Major General Gordon Bennett deployed the Allied defenders south of the Muar River, and it was widely believed here they would finally be able to halt the Japanese. Then the Imperial Guards division outflanked them, performing an amphibious landing and advancing down the coastal route. The 5th Japanese division followed a parallel route through the center, and the 18th division landed near Indao. The Allies were thus surrounded, and they took heavy casualties. Countless were forced to flee through swamps and thick jungle, abandoning all of their stuff. Gordon's 45th Brigade were absolutely shattered, effectively disbanded and left north of the Mar River, as the rest of the Allies fled south. The defeat at Mar broke the British belief that they could hold even a toehold on Malé. Percival's strategy to fight delaying actions until the arrival of reinforcements to Singapore had fatally undermined his troops' ability to hold onto defensive positions. As the British governor of the Johor Straits settlement, Sir Shenton Thomas, would say on January the 6th, "We have gone in for mechanized transport to the 9th degree. It is a fearsomely cumbersome method. We have pinned our faith to a few roads, but the enemy used tracks and paths to get around our rear very much as he likes." And alongside the conquest came a series of atrocities. At the Parrot Sulong Bridge, south of the Muar, Captain Rui Snelling was left behind with 150 wounded Australian and Indian soldiers not able to trek south. The Imperial Guards Division herded them into some buildings, denied them medical treatment. Many of the Indians were beheaded, others were shot. This would become known as the Parrot Sulong Massacre. It's hard to say what Yamashita would have known about this incident. It technically was under the command of Takuma Nishimura. On January the 22nd, Nishimura gave the orders for the prisoners to be forced outside the buildings, to be doused in petrol and set on fire. Nishimura would be sentenced to life in prison by a Singapore court later on after the war. But on a flight back to Japan, he was hijacked by Australian military police in Hong Kong. They grabbed him, held a trial for the Parrot Sulong Massacre, finding him guilty, and they hanged him on June the 11th of 1951. So it seems clear from that perhaps Nishimura did this on his own accord and without Yamashita knowing. Nishimura and Yamashita did not get along after all. But again, it is hard to say what exactly Yamashita knew. When the Japanese reached the Straits of Johor, Yamashita took several days to perform reconnaissance, allowing his forces to regroup and prepare for a massive attack upon Singapore. His plan for the invasion would see the Imperial Guards perform a feint attack on the northeast side of Singapore, landing on a nearby Palu Ubin Island on February the 7th. The 5th and 18th Divisions would remain concealed in the jungle until the night of the 8th, when they would cross the Johor Strait and hit the northwest side of Singapore. The causeway to Singapore had been blown up by the retreating British, but the ability for Singapore to defend itself from a northern attack was going to be quite lackluster. When Churchill was told by Wavell that the Japanese had sat on the other side of the Johor Strait, ready to attack the fortress, he remarked, "I must confess to being staggered by Wavell's telegram. It never occurred to me for a moment that Singapore was not entirely fortified against an attack from the northwards." With barely enough supplies or logistical support for his campaign, Yamashita's rapid advance down the Malay Peninsula walked a tightrope of what was possible. His 70,000 men, of which 30,000 were frontline troops, had overcome a British force double their number. Within Japan, he garnered the epithet Tiger of Malaya, which, ironically, he was not too happy about. Later on in the war, he would bark at a German attaché, "I am not a tiger. The tiger attacks its prey in stealth, but I attack the enemy in a fair play." By this point, Singapore had swollen from a population of 550,000 to nearly a million. Percival had a total of 70,000 infantry of mixed experience, plus 15,000 clerks and support staff who could man the lines if necessary. 38 battalions, 17 Indian, 13 British, 6 Australian, and 2 Malayan were what he had. He placed his weakest troops west of the causeway, near the abandoned naval base rather than nearby the airfield to the right, which he considered was going to be where Yamashita's main thrust would be. Thus, to the east he placed his very best troops, which would prove fatally wrong as Yamashita hit west of the causeway. Yamashita, meanwhile, could muster 30,000 troops. He was outnumbered 2-1, and amphibious assaults called for the attacker to hold a 2-1 advantage for any chance of success. Yamashita's men were exhausted. They had suffered 4,565 casualties, roughly 1,793 deaths in their 55-day advance going south. Worse yet, Yamashita had a critical supply issue. He had greatly exceeded his supply lines and had been surviving on the abandoned Churchill stores along the way. His ammunition was critically low. It is said he was down to 18 functional tanks, allowing his men to only fire 100 rounds per day. The fuel was running out. And as Yamashita would put it, "My attack on Singapore was a bluff. A bluff that worked. I had 30,000 men. I was outnumbered more than 3-1. I knew if I had to fight for long, for Singapore, I would have been beaten. That is why the surrender had to be at once. I was very frightened all the time that the British would discover our numerical weakness and a lack of supplies and force me into disastrous street fighting." Yamashita told his men of the 5th and 18th Divisions not to build any cooking fires so that they could conceal their positions in the jungle, as he gathered hundreds of collapsible boats and other crafts to ford the strait. He gathered 40 divisional commanders and senior officers to a rubber plantation, and with a flushed red face he read out his attack orders while pouring them kikumasamune, ceremonial wine. He made a traditional toast and he said to the men, "It is a good place to die. Surely we shall conquer." He had to get the British to surrender quickly. He, essentially, was bluffing his enemy. He had to make the British think he was fully armed and supplied for a prolonged siege. But how could he do so? He fired his artillery like a madman, knowing full well he would run out of shells quite quickly. Starting on February the 3rd, Yamashita's artillery, supported by aerial bombings, hit Singapore for 5 days. On the night of the 7th, 400 Imperial Guards crossed to the Imbin Island, performing their feint attack. Percival's attention was grabbed to the east successfully, while on the night of the 8th, the 5th and 18th Divisions assembled carefully at the water's edge. At 8:30 p.m., the first wave of 4,000 Japanese troops crossed the Johor Strait, aboard 150 small vessels. The noise of their engines were drowned out by the artillery fire. The thinly spread Australian lines, 3,000 or so men, led by Major General Bennett, were breached fast, leading to pockets of surrounded Australian troops. As a Lewis gunner named Cliff Olson recalled, "We were horribly spread out, and it was pitch black, and the Japanese troops were very hard to see. They walked through us half the time." A beachhead was formed, and soon 14,000 Japanese had crossed by dawn. Communications broke down for the Allies. Percival, unwilling to believe the Japanese main thrust was in the west, declined to send reinforcements there. When he did finally realize the main thrust was in the west, he began to withdraw troops from the quiet sectors, and he built up a reserve. The Japanese held air supremacy, and their artillery was quite fierce. The big 15-inch guns of Singapore held mostly armor-piercing shells designed to hit ships. There were few high-explosive shells available. When they fired upon the Japanese, the shells would hit the ground, they would embed deeply into the ground, and then explode, doing little to no damage. The defenders had no tanks, basically no more aircraft. The last departing ships fled the scene as everything was burning chaos around them. Morale was breaking for the defenders. By the 9th, Japanese bombers were raining bombs on Allied positions unopposed. Bennett was forced to pull men back to a new line of defense from the east of the Tanga airfield to the north of Jurong. Poor communications hampered the northern sector of Brigadier Duncan Maxwell, whose troops actually battered the hell out of the Imperial Guards who had landed at 10 p.m. on the 9th. The Imperial Guards gradually managed to gain a foothold on the beach, but Maxwell feared encirclement and withdrew his men against direct orders from Bennett. The retreat opened up the flank of the 11th Indian Division, who were overrun quickly. All of the beaches west of the causeway fell to the enemy. When they did, Yamashita brought over his tanks to smash the new Jurong line. The Japanese could have potentially stormed the city center at this point, but they held back, because in reality, Percival had created a formidable reserve in the middle. The Australian 22nd Brigade took the brunt of the fighting. Yamashita was running out of reserves, and his attacks were reaching their limit, but he needed the battle to end swiftly. Yamashita was shocked and shaken when he received a report that the British troop strength within the city was twice what they believed. With covert desperation, Yamashita ordered his artillery to fire until their very last rounds, and he sent Percival a demand for surrender. "In the spirit of chivalry, we have the honor of advising your surrender. Your army, founded on the traditional spirit of Great Britain, is defending Singapore, which is completely isolated, and raising the fame of Great Britain by the utmost exertions and heroic feelings. From now on, resistance is futile and merely increases the danger to the million civilian inhabitants without good reason, exposing them to infliction of pain and fire and sword. But the development of the general war situation has already sealed the fate of Singapore, and the continuation of futile resistance would only serve to inflict direct harm and injuries to thousands of non-combatants living in the city, throwing them into further miseries and horrors of war. Furthermore, we do not feel you will increase the fame of the British Army by further resistance." Prior to this message, Singapore had just received an order from Churchill. "It is certain that our troops on Singapore Island greatly outnumber any Japanese that have crossed the straits. We must defeat them. Our whole fighting reputation is at stake, and the honor of the British Empire. The Americans have held out on the Bataan Peninsula against far greater odds. The Russians are turning back the picked strength of the Germans. The Chinese, with almost complete lack of modern equipment, have held the Japanese for many years. It will be disgraceful if we yield our boasted fortress of Singapore to inferior enemy forces. There must be no thoughts of sparing troops or the civilian population, and no mercy must be shown to weakness in any shape or form. Commanders and senior officers must lead their troops and, if necessary, die with them. There must be no question or thought of surrender. Every unit must fight it out to the end and in close contact with the enemy. I look to you and your men to fight to the end to prove that the fighting spirit that won our empire still exists to enable us to defend it." But what was Percival to do? The Japanese had just seized control over Singapore's water reservoirs. The population would die of thirst within 2 to 3 days. Japanese shells were causing fires and death everywhere. People were panicking, trying to get on the very last boats leaving the port, even though that surely meant death to the IGN. An American sailor recalled, "There was a lot of chaos, and people killed on the docks during these bombardments. Everywhere you looked, there was death. Even in the water, there was dead sharks and people floating around." Defeatism was endemic. Australian troops were overheard saying things like, "Chum, to hell with Malaya and Singapore. Navy let us down. Air Force let us down. If the Bung natives won't fight for their bloody country, why pick on me?" Sensing a complete collapse, Percival formed a tight defense arc in front of the city, and by the 13th, his commanders were telling him they believed Singapore was already doomed. Wavell was asked for approval for surrender, but he replied back, "To continue and inflict maximum damage on the enemy for as long as possible by house-to-house fighting, if necessary." Percival then told him the water reservoirs were taken, so Wavell sent back, "Your gallant stand is serving a purpose and must be continued to the limit of endurance." On the 15th, Percival held a morning conference reporting that there was no fuel, field gun, nor Beaufort ammunition. In 24 hours, their water would be done. He told them he would ask for a ceasefire at 4 p.m., and by the end of the day, Wavell had given him permission to surrender. Over at his headquarters in the Bukit Timah Heights, Yamashita was staring at a Union Jack fluttering over Fort Canning. Then a field phone rang, and a frontline commander reported the British were sending out a flag of truce. Meanwhile, back on February the 14th, Japanese forces had reached the Alexandria Barracks Hospital at 1 p.m. At 1:40 p.m., a British lieutenant greeting them, waving a white flag, was bayoneted on the spot. The Japanese stormed the hospital and murdered the staff and patients. 200 male staff and patients, badly wounded, were bound overnight and marched to an industrial estate half a mile away. Anyone who collapsed were bayoneted. The survivors of the march were formed into small groups and hacked to death or bayoneted. For a few days, over 320 men and some women were massacred. Only 5 survivors would give recounts of the event. It is suspected by many historians that Tsuji was the architect of the Alexandria Hospital massacre. This is because he was the instigator of countless other atrocities that he ordered unbeknownst to his superior commanders, such as Yamashita. Percival was ordered to go to the Ford Motor Factory, where he would meet with Yamashita. Yamashita was hiding his surprise that the surrender party came. As he glanced at the surrender terms, he said through his interpreter, "The Japanese army will consider nothing but surrender." Yamashita knew his forces were on the verge of running out of ammunition, and he still held half the troops that Percival did. He was very anxious Percival would figure it all out. Percival replied, "I fear that we shall not be able to submit our final reply before 10:30 p.m. Percival had no intention of fighting on. He simply wanted to work out specific details before signing the surrender. Yamashita was sure Percival was stalling. "Reply to us only whether our terms are acceptable or not. Things must be settled swiftly. We are prepared to resume firing. Unless you do surrender, we will have to carry out a night attack as scheduled." To this, Percival replied, "Cannot the Japanese army remain in its present position? We can resume negotiations again tomorrow at 5:30 a.m. Yamashita screamed, "Nani, I want the hostilities to cease tonight, and I want to remind you there can be no arguments." Percival replied, "We shall discontinue firing by 8:30 p.m. Had we better remain in our present positions tonight?" Yamashita said yes to this, and that the firing would cease at around 8:30 p.m., and that 1,000 Allied men could keep their arms to maintain order within the city. Yamashita also stated, "You have agreed to the terms, but you have not made yourself clear as to whether you agree to surrender or not." Percival cleared his throat, and he gave a simple nod. Yamashita looked over to his interpreter. "There's no need for all of this talk. It is a simple question. I want a simple answer." He turned to Percival and he shouted, "We want to hear yes or no from you. Surrender or fight." And thus, Percival finally blurted out, "Yes, I agree. I have a request to make. Will the Imperial Army protect the women and children and British civilians?" To this, Yamashita replied, "We shall see to it. Please sign this truce agreement." At 7:50 p.m., the surrender was signed off. 40 minutes later, Singapore was in the hands of the Japanese. In 70 days, Yamashita took, at the cost of 9,824 casualties, Malaya and Singapore. Nearly 120,000 British would surrender. It was the greatest land victory in Japanese history. Churchill called the fall of Singapore to the Japanese the worst disaster and largest capitulation in British history. Churchill's physician, Lord Moran, would write, "The fall of Singapore on February the 15th stupefied the Prime Minister. How can 100,000 men, half of them of our own race, hold up their hands to inferior numbers of Japanese? Though his mind had been gradually prepared for its fall, the surrender of the fortress stunned him. He felt it was a disgrace. It left a scar on his mind. One evening, months later, when he was sitting in his bathroom enveloped in a towel, he stopped drying himself and gloomily surveyed the floor. 'I cannot get over Singapore,' he said sadly." With the fall of Singapore came another atrocity, the Suk Ching Massacre. After February the 18th, the Japanese military began mass killings of what they deemed undesirables, mostly ethnic Chinese. It was overseen by the Kempeitai, and it did not stop in Singapore, but spread to the rest of Malaya. It seems the aim of the purge was to intimidate the Chinese community from performing any resistance. According to post-war testimony taken from a war correspondent embedded with the 25th Army, Colonel Hishikari Takafumi, he stated an order went out to kill 50,000 Chinese, of which 20% of the total was issued by senior officials on Yamashita's operation staff, most likely Tsuichi. It is certain, at the behest of Tsuichi, the orders were extended to Malaya. The death toll is a tricky one. The Japanese went on the record to admit to about 6,000 murders. The Singaporean Chinese community and the Prime Minister, Lee Kuan Yew, allege it was something like 70,000 to 100,000. Historians analyzing the scale of discovered mass graves after decades think around 25 to a possible 50,000 had died. How much Yamashita knew of the massacre is debatable. The orders came from his office, after all. But it seems Tsuichi had orchestrated it. Many of Japan's generals wanted Yamashita to be appointed war minister after this, a move that obviously threatened the then Prime Minister Hideki Tojo, who of course feared his rival. Tojo retaliated, ordered Japan's new war hero back to Manchuria. On the surface, the assignment appeared worthy, as Yamashita would serve as the first line of defense against a possible Soviet invasion. But since the two nations had signed a neutrality pact in April of 1941, the Soviets were bogged down fighting the Germans. Immediate war appeared unlikely. In reality, Tojo had parked Yamashita on the war's sidelines. Tojo went even further than this. He barred Yamashita any leave in Tokyo, preventing him from visiting his wife as well as from delivering any speeches that he had written for the emperor. No worries, though. An aide of Yamashita sent him three geishas. Allegedly, he said to this, "I know they want to please me with these girls, but send them back, and don't forget to tip them." The Tiger of Malaya would maintain a low profile in Manchuria, where he received a promotion to full general. As months fell to years, Yamashita sat on the sidelines, helpless to aid the Japanese forces. His exile would come to an end in 1944 when Tojo was outed, and the Tiger was required to try and save the Philippines from one General Douglas MacArthur. And that's it for this rather short piece on Tomoyuki Yamashita and how he became the Tiger of Malaya. Again, thanks to all of you for joining the Patreon, and if you want to hear something else, something specific, please just leave it in the comments, especially whenever I put up some polls. We'll see if we can make a podcast dedicated to your needs. Until then, this has been the Pacific War Channel, over and out.